And you do-si-do with a corner lady. Do-si-do with your own little baby.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast in which I and my two good buddies, Sean Engel and Andy Leyland, hello, boys.
Hello there.
Are going through the vastly underrated series Star Trek Deep Space Nine and going episode by episode, giving plot synopsises and discussing them, all the while having fun and maybe learning a little something along the way. Today we are covering episode 7 of season 2, Rules of Acquisition. Woo! Before we get to that, does anybody have any Star Trek discussion you'd like to bring up?
The only thing that I've seen, and by the time we get this episode out, it'll probably be old news. Well, of course it'll be old news anyway, because we're recording these far in advance. They finally settled on a title for the new Star Trek film.
Okay. Star Trek 3, This Doesn't Suck.
For non-suckage.
We could only hope it would be Star Trek 3, We're Trying to Not Make This Suck. No, they actually released it, and I don't know how impressed or bored you're going to be by the name of it.
But it's not a new hope, is it?
Damn, you're spot on.
An old hope.
Actually, no, it's even more sort of tepid than that. It's Star Trek Beyond.
Beyond what?
I don't know. At least it's not like the last movie, Star Trek Into Darkness, where there should have been a semicolon after Star Trek rather than it being like a sort of run-on sentence. It just, I don't know. It doesn't really tell you anything about the movie. It doesn't tell you anything at all. It's just Star Trek.
Is this the working title, or is this actually going to be the title of the film?
I think this is the actual title of the film, Star Trek Beyond.
Going into this, not your hopes of what it's going to be, but your expectations. Do you have any expectations as to where this storyline is going to go?
No, I've no expectations at all, because Simon, I saw an interview with Simon Pegg where he said Idris Elba, isn't it, that they've got
in it? I believe so.
Yes.
Is not going to be playing a character from the TV show. And his exact quote was, we're now into the 5-year mission, the original show didn't do sequels every week, we're going to tell a completely new story. And based on that, I'm with him.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say, that gives me hope. But yeah, my expectations are essentially it. I think like I said before, I think the cast is good. I think they're looking for a good director and a good screenplay. You get those, and I think the cast can pull it off. But
I think Simon Pegg is aware of the problems of the first two. He's been very diplomatic about it because he knows who pays his paycheck. But I think he's of them all, he's the one who actually talks and engages with fans. because when people said, is Into Darkness the worst of the lot, he was quoted as saying, tell fans to fuck off, it isn't. And but if you actually read what he said, his basically reply was, fuck off, no it's not. And then he actually got into a dialogue about the film itself. It was just a casual throw out. He didn't actually say, tell the fans fuck off.
Who's a friendly.
Yeah, basically. And I think he's aware of our problems with them. Now, whether or not he's in a position to be able to fix all of that, I mean, I don't know how much involvement Paramount have or how much involvement J.J. Abrams will have, because it seems like all of the stupid decisions from the previous two came from Abrams when you start reading interviews and scripts and stuff.
Mm.
But the guy who wrote the last one was on the Mission Log podcast, and he was just an idiot. I'm sorry, yeah. But he was basically talking about the Mission Log guys actually said to him, well, why did you just do lines and quotes from Wrath of Khan? And his defense for that was, yeah, well, if you watch that with people who don't know that we ripped off the earlier movie, it works well. That's not a defense.
No.
Especially since, at least, I mean, if you're lucky enough to have gotten young viewers, then it's still at least 50% of your office of your audience is old viewers who've seen it and are going to know.
Yeah, and he said basically the idea of making it Khan came from Abrams, and the idea basically was this. Well, why can't it be Khan? That's not proper organic storytelling. I'm sorry, but it isn't. Well, why can't it? Well, why can't it be Abraham Lincoln if we're going to do it like that? He was in Star Trek. So I've got faith in Simon Pegg more than I have faith in anyone else who's involved with the behind-the-scenes production of the film. But like I say, I don't know how much he's working from an original idea or if he's just rewriting the script they've already got. I've no idea. But Simon Pegg's not disappointed me whenever he's written his own stuff. He's been in some shitty films, but shitty films that he had nothing to do in the writing side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like How to Make Friends and...
Yeah,
The one where he's a runner, Run Fat Boy Run. Yeah. You know, those were just bland movies, but movies like he's done with Edgar Wright, the Coronado trilogy we've referenced before, those are all fantastic, intelligent, witty movies. And they're also very reverential. Like Hot Fuzz is both a parody and an homage to all those wonderful 80s ridiculous over-the-top action-type movies. It's a reference to set in a
sleepy English country.
Exactly. Well, and
so you're taking that wonderful "we've got loads of money" American explosions and "I'm too old for this shit" stuff and dumping it in the least likely place, and it worked. I think Hot Fuzz is massively underrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I again call back to the next movie, The World's End. That turned the idea of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz around and made Nick Frost the hero of that. And it's been said that that is the best John Carpenter film that John Carpenter has not made, you know, in decades. And it's a very clever film. It's well written, brilliant dialogue. It's funny. It's got depth to it. And Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright are the guys who are behind that. And I think Simon Pegg can, hopefully, if he's allowed to do what he wants to do and is allowed to be faithful to Star Trek, can give us a good movie.
Yeah, it's a pity he can't rope Edgar Wright into directing it.
Mm.
I never saw Hot Fuzz, so I may have to see that. But
it's
World's End, I enjoyed very much. I thought that was an underrated movie. I expect that we're going to see the Klingons in this movie. I think they kind of set the stage for that in the last one, and that's kind of the natural place to go. And whether or not that works is really independent of the script. You could easily do Klingons, but do them in a way, you know, don't mirror past stuff. And as saddened as we all are by the passing of Leonard Nimoy, I actually think a minor plus is the fact that they're not going to just trot him out again in this movie, because they can't. Because I think I think it was kind of a combination of it being a little bit of a crutch that when they used them last time, and also them feeling like they had to.
Yes.
Yeah. It was very, he turned down Generations, but he did this cameo. Whereas in the 09 one, I kind of understood why he did it. From his point of view, it made sense to do it. His story was integral to the plot, even though he's only in the film for about 9 minutes. And it was his essentially passing it on to Zachary Quinto. His cameo into Darkness was pointless.
Yeah, it really was. And I think that they would have kept trotting him out every movie if he was still alive.
Yeah.
And not that I mind seeing Leonard Nimoy, but he served no purpose in the movie whatsoever. In fact, he kind of served a contradictory purpose to what he should, where he starts, you know, I can't tell you about anything about your future, except let me tell you about Khan.
While I'm here, let me tell you about the Genesis device. I know why I'm here. Let me tell you all about these other things that are going to happen to you.
Yeah, he was basically Space Siri, essentially. You know, hey, Siri, Siri, what about this enemy I'm facing? Spock, Siri.
Spock, tell me about Khan, Noonien, Singh. I do not know the word Noonien.
I always think of the Saturday Night Live skit when William Shatner was hosting it at the Star Trek convention. And, you know, when he tells the fans to get a life.
Yes.
But before they do that, you know, they show the fans talking and they're doing the, there's like a quiz that was handed around. It's, did you get Khan's middle name? And the guy just looks at him and says, Noonien.
anyway, that's all I've heard. Has Planet of the Apes Star Trek finished yet?
Yes, it has. I'm 2 issues behind in my reading, but it has finished.
Okay, well, I will read all of that then and look forward to you covering it on Back to the Bins.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to covering it on Back to the Bins, and I'll give away my position at this point, because who knows, this episode might end up airing after we do that anyway. But as of two issues left to read, I'm thinking thumbs up.
Was it 5 or 6?
5, I believe.
Right.
I'm trying to remember now. It's early in the morning here. Okay. Not quite as early as it is by Sean, but it's early.
I'm fine. I've had my coffee. I'm ready to go.
Oh, shut up.
This is why I love working with you guys.
Anyway, rules of acquisition.
A Ferengi will do anything for profit.
I've waited my whole life for an opportunity like this.
He'll go to any lengths.
It never hurts to suck up to the boss.
To get what he wants.
This is not about profit anymore, it's about love.
For the reward.
It's a lot of land now.
Is always worth the risk.
I should have killed you back on that station.
Or is it?
You're a woman?
It's a female!
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Was again episode 7 of season 2, directed by David Livingston, teleplay by Ira Stephen Bear. Story by Hilary Bader, and it featured the great Wallace Shawn as Grand Nagus Zek, and Helene Udi as Pell. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the ever fun Tiny Ron as, however you pronounce his last name, Mardu, or his name. Anyway, Grand Nagus Zek plans to establish a Ferengi business presence in the Gamma Quadrant and wants to purchase a large amount of tulipberry wine from a species called the Dosi. Zek enlists Quark as his representative, and Quark asks Pell, one of his Ferengi waiters, to be his assistant. Unbeknownst to Quark, Pell is a female. Ferengi females are not allowed to wear clothing, earn money, or leave Ferenginar, so she is forced to keep her identity a secret. However, Pell proves to be a valuable assistant. At the meeting with the Dosi, Quark and Pell request 10,000 vats of wine, but the Dosi offer them half of that. They are close to making a deal when Zek informs Quark that he now wants 100,000 vats. When Quark tells the Dosi what Zek said, they leave the station. Zek is furious, but Pell steps in and informs him that she and Quark plan to follow the Dosi back to the Gamma Quadrant. The two of them travel to the Dosi homeworld and find that the Dosi have a Ferengi-like desire for profit and Klingon-like tempers. The Dosi, from whom Quark and Pell were originally going to buy the wine, still refuses their offer. Another Dosi informs them that the entire planet does not have 100,000 vats of tulipberry wine, but she offers to put them in contact with another race she calls the Karima, for a price. The Karima are a powerful member of what the Dosi call the Dominion, and when Quark and Pell hear the name, they realize Zek's true intentions. He has no interest in tulipberry wine. He wants to find out more about the Dominion. Although they return to the station empty-handed, Zek tells Quark and Pell that he intentionally requested more wine than the Dosi could provide in order to make contact with someone from the Dominion. Unfortunately, while Quark and Pell were gone, Rom discovered Pell's true identity. He tells Quark, who instantly faints. When he wakes up, Quark orders Rom not to tell anyone, knowing his own career could be ruined. Pell later reveals her identity to Zek herself, but when Zek threatens to put Quark and Pell in prison, he realizes that he too did business with Pell. The group decides to keep Pell's identity a secret, and she leaves to make a new life in the Gamma Quadrant. The end. You know what? You put Wallace Shawn on the screen, I'm enjoying an episode. It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
he's not entirely different from Garrick.
Now, do you think that the makeup changed a bit from the first time around? He looked, maybe it was more the lighting, but he looked a bit different from when he appeared the first time in the Negus. I mean, maybe it's, you know, his ear hair was just more accentuated. Maybe that's just one of the things I noticed, but he looked a bit, I think the lighting effects on him, or the lighting around the station, made him look a bit younger, maybe? I don't know.
Didn't notice that he looked younger, no.
Okay.
I did like play easier her all the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Paul was going to finish his thought.
Go right ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I to me, he always looks old and decrepit, so that didn't really jump out at me.
That's just me, then.
I don't know where exactly to go. One thing is, having seen this episode before, and it was a while since I saw it, I didn't really remember the episode, but I did remember very, very quickly the plot once I started to watch it. I don't remember ever it being a big moment to realize that Pell was a female. I think it was kind of obvious early on. I don't know if that takes anything away from it, but I think it might have been better if they had done a slightly better job of hiding that. Otherwise, I thought it was well written. It was kind of fun. It brings in the Dominion, which is always nice.
Mm-hmm. The first mention of them.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, they're going to become huge on this show. They're going to become the focus of the show. But just they did it in a very subtle way, just to do it, you know, in on an episode that you almost think of as a throwaway episode. So I didn't really like the alien makeup that we saw on the Dosi. It just kind of seemed silly again. Like it was almost like the move along home makeup.
But, well, I can never see Brian Thompson and not think of the opening of the Terminator. Nice night for walk, huh?
Was that who that guy was?
Yeah, it's Bill Paxton and Brian Thompson and another guy that nobody ever remembers. But Brian Thompson's one of those guys who spent most of his career behind makeup. He's in a lot of Buffy and Angel, and he's in a lot of Star Trek, I think, normally playing Klingons. So he's when you see him, his facial structure is very similar to Arnold Schwarzenegger, so he's quite recognizable when you see him. But in the opening of the Terminator, he's the guy that Arnie steals the clothes from. He doesn't steal Bill Paxton's or the other guys. He steals Brian Thompson's because they are similar build.
Is he the one who gets the hand through the chest, or is that another person?
Yes, I think that is him, I think.
See, the Dosi or the Dosi or whatever they are, they reminded me of some of the ancillary characters, like in Ming's Ballroom in the 1980 Flash Gordon film.
Yeah, you know, they kind of had that sort of... was a bit campy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it did sort of belie these people to be sort of threatening characters from the Gamma Quadrant. You know, the little painted dots with basically Pac-Man tracks around their faces just didn't really sell them as being, you know, some sort of formidable enemy that the Furring gear are going to have to deal with.
I think, you know, I like the episode, and anytime Wallace Shawn is on the screen, I enjoy it. But I thought they also could have done a slightly better job of giving him a little bit more pointed dialogue than they did.
I like this one a lot. I like that it zigs and zags around quite a bit, because you think it's just going to be a flat-out comedy.
Yeah, and you think it's going to be a throwaway episode again, but it's the major antagonist for the rest of the run of the series.
Yeah, the Dominion are introduced in this throwaway comedy episode.
I didn't remember the turn of Pell being a female until she actually sat down and removed the ears. I went, oh, now it finally clicked with me again. I think maybe it's just me being kind of naive and not really noticing all that much, but I just thought it was kind of a sort of squeaky voiced Ferengi. I think they covered her up well enough that you didn't see any of the sort of shapeliness of her. It wasn't until she took the jacket off that you saw, oh, hey, breasts.
I think it was more the face and the voice that you could, you know, if you were looking close enough, you could see that it was a girl all along.
See, I think I remembered her, because from the beginning I was like, that's a girl. So I think I remembered the not so much twist.
That's exactly the situation I was in. I remembered it from the first time I saw it, but the first time I saw it, I think I figured it out right away also. I didn't think they did that good of a job of hiding it.
I like the little character bits that Dax likes hanging around with the Ferengis.
I like that she beats them.
Yeah, and she beats them at what she's doing, which I thought was quite nice. And I liked that Zex always putting his hand on Kira's ass.
Well, it's
because Nana Vista just plays it beautifully every time he does it. Her face just does that shock thing, and then it hardens as if you do that again, I'm going to cut your hand off. But he keeps doing it.
See, and I think we get some good character development with Dax here that we'll see be brought more into later episodes where she's dealing more with the Klingons. It shows that this character Dax, having all, what, like 7 different lifetimes, has been able to experience a lot. And she realizes, and she states even in the show, that once you come to understand what the Ferengi are like and how to interact with them, you just go with it. And we're getting a lot more character development with Dax in this episode than we have in previous episodes, even ones that were specifically Dax-oriented, in my thought. So yeah. I enjoyed this a lot.
She's a very old character in a young body. She's seen a lot of things. She knows not to just judge people on what they look like. She's very, which is the point of the episode, encapsulated in Dax's little subplot. Because there is also a little bit of this one about sexism, although they don't really get to go there. They seem to be having too much fun just laughing it up. But at some point, they kind of forget the message of the episode, which isn't a bad thing, because they're not beating you over the head with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they'll get more into the sort of, you know, sexist nature of the Ferengi as we go along in the series, when we actually get to go to Ferenginar, whatever the Ferengi home planet is, and meet with Quark's parents, or at least Quark's mom. So that'll be an interesting, you know, and I think there are some things in this episode that are sort of contradicted and later on in the next few episodes that they deal with the Ferengi, specifically how they aren't supposed to take advice from females, yet eventually later on Grand Nagus Zek is actually taking advice from Quark's mom. But that's way out of the...
Yeah, maybe he learned something from this.
Well, and you know, the name of the episode, of course, was Rules of Acquisition, and we get a lot of the rules sort of drop throughout the show, and eventually you'll find out that the Rules of Acquisition are kind of being built upon, you know, throughout the series, and I think Zek actually adds to some of them, and some of them, I think, come from Quark's mom, if I'm recalling, but, you know, like, again, that's in the future.
Do they actually keep a track of what number which rule is which?
I think they do, because I remember when we were watching, when I was watching Voyager, because there were a couple of episodes where they were in, when they're in the Delta Quadrant, they encountered some Ferengis that were somehow warped into the Delta Quadrant as well, and they were rewriting the Rules of Acquisition and adding to them. And I think online somewhere, and this was back in when the internet was just, you know, dial-up, that there was a site that had a list of all the rules of acquisition, 180 or so of them. So,
yeah,
I think they do a pretty decent job of keeping track of them. But you know, of course, it's not like Morn sightings. I'm not going to make sure that, you know, Rule 33 is actually Rule 33 throughout the entirety of the show.
We're not going to be that nitpicky.
No, I don't think we need to go that far.
Well, I think we're going to have to hand our podcasting hats in.
Well, we're at least making sure that Morn's in the episode, and I think this is a great, you know, Morn's at the very beginning of the episode, and I think it's a brilliant little part where he's essentially sleeping on a park bench in the promenade. And, you know, when Odo tells him to get up and he needs to go home, where does he go? Right to the bar. I thought that's brilliant.
There's a brilliant exchange. The writing in this episode is actually really spot on. In the Deep Space Nine Companion, they do say that the executive producer, Iron Bear, thinks they went a little bit over the top. I don't agree with him. I don't think they went over the top enough, apart from on the makeup, on the doozy. But the exchange at the end with Quark and Zek were quite basically turns Zek's own words on him when he says, I didn't know she was a female, stupidity is no excuse, and then Quark turns that back at him. He's brilliantly written and brilliantly performed by Armin Shimerman.
Yeah, I don't think this is as comedic an episode as we did have with the Negus. There's a bit more serious things, you know, falling in love, you know, the idea of sexual repression by the Ferengi, you know, the desire to keep women down in the Ferengi culture. There's a lot more difficult subjects that they're dealing with in this episode. So the humor actually kind of works better to sort of break up that kind of heaviness that they're putting forth in it.
Do you think that's why Quark and Zek are so fascinated by Kira and Dax? Because they're not Ferengi women.
Yeah, I think that if you want to put some depth in the characterization, I think so.
Because Zek seems very taken with Kira. I mean, understandably so. And Quark's constantly flirting with Dax.
If you come from a culture that, you know, oppresses women like that, odds are there's going to be one of two reactions to women like Kira and Dax. Either you're going to be attracted to them for being different from what you're used to as they are in this, or you're going to be offended by them. And the offended part would probably wear thin very quickly. So this is something
that works with. Yeah. Sean's gone.
No, I'm here. I'm trying to think how you relate that to certain groups of individuals in our culture who demean women in such a manner, and whether they would find a woman who's powerful and forthright and, you know, in charge of her own destiny, like Kira or Dax would be, you know, how they would feel about, you know, someone like that. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's sort of a parallel that they're trying to make on Deep Space Nine to what's going on in current times.
So. What occurred to me, and I bear with me because I'm not sure if this is a good thought or not, but I think there's been some criticism of the Ferengi as being basically as making fun of the Jewish stereotype with money and all of that. I thought the treatment of women actually goes totally to the opposite of that, because in Israel, I think women are very empowered. You know, they have to serve in the military, and they're not treated as second class citizens. So I thought this went against that thought that somehow it's,
yeah,
you know,
it does,
being a comedic version of the Jewish stereotype.
Again, I think the Ferengi just sort of play on a lot of negative stereotypes, not specifically any one culture or any one religious group or anything like that. They're just a bunch of selfish stereotypes.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think that stereotype is kind of ridiculous, to be honest with you. But,
well,
you know, most stereotyping is.
Well, yeah, I agree. It's just it's a way people can simplify a characterization of someone down to something, you know, just a simple idea. And a lot of times it's more nuanced than that. And I think Deep Space Nine and the characters of the Ferengi, especially Quark and Zek, you know, are far more deep than that.
Especially in when they're played so well and written so well as they are in this. There's another really good Dax bit as well, when she thinks that Pell's in love with Quark, but she doesn't know that it's a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not bothered. She doesn't treat it any differently. She's very, you should tell him. And I like that. I like it when Star Trek does something where it's not hanging a big neon sign over it saying we're doing the gay episode.
Yes.
Like there's an episode of Next Gen. Yeah, there's an episode of Next Gen with
Riker
falls for somebody, and they're from an androgynous society or something, mm-hmm. and they're hanging a big neon sign over we're doing the gay episode. This is how you do it. You did it perfectly in this episode. Dax, it's just not a big deal to her. She's just very, you should go and tell her. I don't care that you're a man. Go on, go and do what you're doing. And then she realizes that it's not a man. And there is something really wonderful about the character of Dax when she's played really well, that she is really very open to everybody else because of how long she's lived.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also, I'm trying to remember if the reveal of Pell kissing Quark on the shuttle, if that happened before the reveal that she's a female, or if it happened afterwards.
It's after, because she goes into her quarters and takes her top off before that happens.
Hmm.
Not actually, we don't get boobs or anything. Just in case you get excited, lovely listeners.
Now, if it were Dax or Kira, like we'd get excited.
Yeah, well, Angela's watching this one with me because she quite likes Deep Space Nine, and she keeps marveling at how Kira gets into that outfit.
It is stunning, isn't it?
I think tight was the word she used, but,
She fills it out well.
She does.
Episode
that's about tolerance where be really sexist.
Well, we're portraying the Ferengis.
We are, yeah. I can understand. We're not enlightened 24th century men.
True.
I do love Zach keeps touching her ass. I just thought that was the funniest running gag in the episode. I was complete disinterest in him. Doesn't put him off at all to the point where he's sending her gifts and she doesn't want to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And he even follows that up with, well, all right, what about just a night of hot passion?
and Wallace Shawn plays it so beautifully. When she comes to deliver it back, he's like, he's giving her to come here and, sit on my lap type thing. He's so wonderfully loathsome that it's just a joy to watch him perform this.
Yeah, he's great in it. But he's great in them all, isn't he? Whenever he shows up, he's good in it.
Yeah, I have no memory of any episode with Wallace Shawn that I didn't love. Or at least like a lot. Love is probably too strong.
Mm.
And certainly, even if I didn't love the episode, I loved his performance, because he's gold every time he's on the screen.
Agreed.
Much like Garrick.
Yeah, well, this is where, this early in the second season is where we start, Deep Space Nine starts building its recurring characters up. Because we've seen Dukat come back, we've seen Garrick come back, we've now seen Zek come back, we've probably got more returns in Deep Space Nine than we have in Next Gen and the original combined. Because
mm-hmm.
The Next Gen only really had Q and Lwaxana. And
true.
The original didn't have anybody who came back more than twice. No. Every time they tried to bring John Colicos back as a Klingon, he was busy. So they had to rename the Klingons every time they tried to do it.
Yeah,
so,
we had Mudd as a reaction.
Yeah, we had Harry Mudd in two episodes, and that's pretty much it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Deep Space Nine's building up its loyal backstory, its loyal recurring characters, and that's what starts in the second season. And as we go through, they'll start developing them much more, and we'll actually get to the point where we're happy to see them whenever they come back. It isn't like, oh god, it's the Lwaxana episode. It's always, oh, Zek's in this one. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we have anything else? Do you guys have anything else? Have we talked enough about Rules of Acquisition?
I like that the pack leads were in it.
Yeah, I noticed that.
The episode of Next Generation is god awful, but it was nice to see them in the background. Yeah, we need things to make us go. Why don't you just go away?
Obviously, we can mention the fact that we open with Morn.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, I thought that was perhaps one of the best. Ever since the last Wallace Shawn episode, where we had Morn, outside the bar just waiting to come in, and Quark's kind of shooing away. This is one of the best Morn scenes that we've had in a while.
And if you haven't watched the episode, Morn is basically sleeping on the promenade and gets shooed away by Odo.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Mm. It is closing time.
To me, the scene of Morn looking in the window and not being allowed in the bar in that last episode is still the highlight of Morn so far.
He needed a cliff, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did. I mean, you know, it was funny because I watched it for a long time before I realized that Morn is Norm spelled backwards. Anyway, I guess we're ready to rate this thing.
Yep.
And it's my episode. So you had Zek in there. You had a good story. You had the introduction of the Dominion. I think it probably would be, without all the window dressing, it would probably be a 3.5 star one for me, slightly above average. But I think there's just enough extra in there that I'm going to go to 4 on it.
Okay, cool. I'll go ahead and go next. I'm going to give it a 4 as well. You know, I thought there was, you know, we got recurring characters back. Wallace Shawn is always brilliant. We got the, you know, despite the fact that we get these sort of goofy-faced aliens from the Gamma Quadrant, which it seems like most of the alien races that we've got from the Gamma Quadrant have been, you know, either 80s porn stars or guys with Pac-Man lines on their faces, so whatever. We need to get a good devious race, and the fact that we get the first mention of the Dominion here, you know, definitely bumps this episode up. So, 4 bars of gold breast latinum for me.
3.5. It's a good, enjoyable, fun episode. I kind of think the point of it gets a little bit lost amidst the fun. But it's certainly highly enjoyable, and I think it shows the flexibility of Star Trek's format, that they can go from doing rom-com last week to outright farce this week to dark brooding next week in the space of 3 weeks.
Yep.
Just I'm looking at Memory Alpha as we're talking about, and this episode was originally pitched for a TNG episode.
Ooh, I can't see it working very well as a TNG episode.
The original story had Pell involved with Will Riker. Beverly Crusher would subsequently find out, and she and Pell would develop a kind of sisterhood.
Right. I think they made the right decision porting it over to Deep Space Nine.
I think so. Usually the failed TNG scripts are the less stellar episodes. So it's nice to see that they made a quality episode with a failed TNG premise. I don't think they may not have actually been a script.
No, they probably just did a complete page one rewrite on it if there was a script. So it wasn't like they just crossed off a few names like we've suspected that they may have done on other episodes. This was heavily rewritten because there won't have been an analog character for some of the other people on Deep Space Nine in the next gen script.
Yeah, I don't think
just, just because I'm anal retentive, I'm going to have to say analogous.
That's the one. Thank you very much. Analogous.
Well, you English people say everything different anyway. You could just say that's how it's pronounced over there.
That's how it's pronounced. It's like,
got,
you know,
it's got an extra U in there somewhere.
Yeah. Over here we say analog.
Aluminium. Aluminium.
Aluminum.
Say it with me.
Molybdenum. Molybdenum. So do we want to get to some emails?
Incoming transmission.
Do we have any?
No.
Excellent. Good. Right. Bye then.
So,
see you next week.
So everyone who's listening, please, please, please write us some emails. We'd love to read your emails on the show. We'd love to hear what you have to say about the show. I guess having Gene on is kind of a deterrent because it takes away, 30% of our listenership, 33% of our listenership. So please write into the show. We love reading your emails, everyone.
I would also love to start getting a couple of iTunes reviews from our 3 loyal listeners.
You know, that's true. Nice. I haven't checked iTunes. I think Gene left us an iTunes review. Yeah, we've got one from Gene Hendricks. Do we want to read
Yay.
That?
Yay! Yes, go on, read the iTunes review.
Okay, sure. I'm not certain if we've read it before, but we'll go ahead and read it, you know, again, if we have. It's a 5-star review.
You know what? It's a 1 iTunes rating. I think we should read it every episode.
All right, then. And okay, here's the threat then. Every episode, we're going to read the same iTunes review unless someone else comes in and writes an iTunes review. So go out there and incentivize yourself and write an iTunes review for Listen to the Prophets. This one, of course, is from our good friend Gene Hendricks, and it says, a wonderful look back. He says, this is a great way to look back at the best Star Trek show that isn't the original. As opposed to the wagon train, we instead have the Rifleman, and it is an interesting take on things. Join Sean, Andrew, and Paul as they look back at this most underappreciated installment of Star Trek. Very entertaining and informative, and if I didn't mention, that was a 5-star review from Gene Hendricks, Gene, the podcasting machine. Thank you, Gene.
Yes, thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
So, and yes.
Everybody else who hasn't reviewed us, shame on you.
I don't know if shaming them is going to get them to write podcast reviews.
They listen to our show, clearly. They have no shame.
Oh, well, that's true. All right, well, since our email bag is empty and we've already read our 1 iTunes review, let's go ahead and hit up what's going to be coming up next time.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets. Just one more thing, Mr. Columbo.
You know, I think everyone's going to realize. I think that was going to be everyone's note. This is basically Space Columbo.
Yay! Yeah. Necessary Evil, one of the best episodes they ever did. We're not burying the lead on this one.
Not at all.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
I have multiple computers in the house, and the one in the basement that is what I normally use to record because I don't want to wake everybody else up. I kept signing into Skype, and it would start, and then it would say, Skype is not working.
Huh.
So I had to come to a different computer, so I may be talking a little low.
That's fine. You sound fine. Sound good.
Well, as good as I can.
Well.
Let's not overstate it.
Well, we're not supposed to be – none of us are professional voice – radio talent
in a world.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I always figured this was how I was going to get discovered.
keep that dream alive, sir. Keep it alive.
That's worked well for me for the past 5 years.
Oh, look at that. Dr. Bill is on.
Is he joining us?
I know he said he has to work today, but he said if he got up early enough, he might, or if he had enough time to watch an episode, he might try and jump in for a little while.
Okay.
So if you want to add him to the call, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I mean, I know, you know, it's Dr. Bill.
Well.
Down. You know, right now you're thinking, well, my standards are such that I do a show with you. I might as well have Dr. Bill on, too.
Doesn't get any lower.
Hey, folks. Sean Engel here from Listen to the Prophets. I'm going to be telling you here that the conversation you're going to be hearing after the beep is going to be a conversation that Paul, Dr. Bill, Andy, and I had about the new Avengers movie, Age of Ultron. Now, there's going to be spoilers in here, so if you don't want to be spoiled for the film, then I suggest you don't listen. However, if this episode is coming out when I think it is, it'll probably be about time for Avengers Age of Ultron to be coming out on Blu-ray and DVD. So, you've probably already seen it. So, enjoy our conversation about Avengers Age of Ultron.
I was planning, you know, has everyone seen Age of Ultron yet?
Yeah.
We've all seen it. Andy saw it like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, something like that. I've forgotten about it. We've seen Ant-Man by now.
Wibbly wobbly, whatever.
Well, it's you know, I'll throw in yesterday Bill and I went on and we did you know, a 5-minute freak, which took probably 20 minutes to do a 5-minute freak, but my thoughts then were I'm going to need to see it a second time in order to kind of really place it in where it belongs among the other Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And having had a night to sleep on it, I'm feeling more solidified in what we said yesterday, that I would give the first Avengers movie an A. I would give this an A-.
Yeah, I think it's a better film. The first Avengers, sorry, is a better film than this one. And I don't.
The first one is much more.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
it's packed, it's tighter. You don't need to have seen any of the others to enjoy the Avengers. And I don't think it's as good a film as Guardians of the Galaxy, but it's still fucking good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this one was slightly less accessible if you didn't know the source material.
Oh well, that's
not that you had to know the source material, but I think the source material actually made a difference in your viewing pleasure.
Yeah, the complaints I've seen about it, there's too many characters, there's too much plot, there's too much action. Whereas I'm like, yeah, that was 70s Marvel Comics.
And too much action is a silly criticism, actually, because the first one is almost nonstop action.
Yeah. It's very much a 70s Marvel comic brought to the screen. That's what it is. There's a shit ton of characters in those old comics, a shit ton of plot and subplot and action and development over a long period of time. If I had a complaint about Avengers 2, it just felt like it was a 3-hour movie cut down to 2 hours 20 minutes. It felt like there should have been more. There should have been Thor, it seemed to me, got short shrift in the editing room.
And you would be right, because... good morning, everybody.
Hey, Bill!
Josh Whedon said that that he wants to put out that it is like a 3-hour-plus movie that he filmed, and that they'll probably put out a longer cut.
Right, because it did feel like that watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently there's some Loki scenes, whether or not they're in that whole dream sequence or mental thing. Most likely, I would imagine.
If your scenes get cut from the film, do they not count towards your contract?
I
would suspect that you have to film them. I don't, you know, if they choose not to release it, I don't think that's your problem.
Yeah, but if they release it in a special edition, I'm sure they still get paid.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, they still get paid, but does it count to his 6-film contract if he doesn't end up being in the film?
I bet it does.
You reckon?
I'm thinking, you know, like I said, you know, you film it, it's up to them whether they want to release it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd probably have to agree with you. I thought the first Avengers movie was more cohesive. I enjoyed the movie, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I did Winter Soldier or Guardians of the Galaxy. I think those and the first Avengers are probably the highest, would be the ones I've rated the highest. This one was good. I'd probably give it a B+. And it might kind of stem from my just sort of general feelings about Joss Whedon, the way he writes the show. There were a bunch of Whedonisms in there. There were the good ones, like, you know, giving a lot of characterization to Scarlett Johansson as the Black Widow. I thought that was great. Of course, they had to have the random person getting killed for apparently no reason. Of course, Quicksilver dying. There's no guarantee that he's actually dead, but you know, it was one of those unexpected things that happens in every Joss Whedon film, you know.
See,
Wash.
I disagree with that, and there's somebody on Facebook who's got a real bee in his bonnet about Whedon doing that, going back to him killing Wash in Serenity. I honestly felt in both cases it serves the story he's telling. Wash's death serves the ending of Serenity beautifully, because you're smacked about the face that, wait a minute, he's just killed a regular. This is serious. They may not make it through this. And it's the same here. Quicksilver's gone through the entire movie caring only about his sister. And at the end of the film, he does a selfless act and dies for it. That's a heroic journey. It works in the confines of this film. Do I want him to kill somebody off in every film he makes? No. But well, again, within the confines of this movie, it worked just as well as killing Coulson in the first one.
Well, I don't disagree with you there, but it's just become such a trope to his films that you tend to expect it. You've seen it in Firefly, you've seen it in the first Avengers films with Cole. So
for that, when Angela's going into the film saying, "Who's he going to kill this time?"
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those.
I almost like the he's going to kill Hawkeye.
Yeah, well,
sorry, Sean.
Well, but that's one of the things I actually enjoyed about the film. The little scenes, finding out that Hawkeye has a family and kids and that we didn't know about. That was one of the most rewarding scenes in the movie. I liked the action scenes were amazing and the fight scenes and everything were really great. But what got me interested the most in the films were little downtime films. The conversations between Scarlett Johansson and Mark Ruffalo, Hawkeye dealing with Linda Cardellini, his wife, and the kids and everything. Those were the scenes that really worked best for me. Was anyone kind of... When they did the evacuation of the city that was floating off into space, did anyone feel that that was kind of sort of a call out to, you know, previous or people who were arguing online or fans of other movies who said that, you know, there should have been, the Avengers should have tried to make sure that there was minimal loss of life?
Yeah,
no, because it was definitely that, but he did it in the first one. At the end big fight at the end of the first one, he makes the point of having Captain America say,
people out of here.
Get the civilians out.
Yeah, I think it was much more, for lack of a better word, heavy-handed in this one.
I think this one they specifically, you know, sort of nailed it home. We're getting everyone we can out of here because we don't want to see all this collateral damage. And it's kind of a smack in the face to, in my opinion, what happened in Man of Steel and the complaints a lot of people had about that.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it depends on whether you feel that that's a valid complaint about Man of Steel or not.
It seemed more subtle in the first Avengers, you know, with Captain America just barking orders to do that, you know, and you know, I think that felt more subtle. This felt a bit more forced.
Is it more subtle or are we just as fans noticing it more?
Probably a little bit of the latter, I would say.
But I think he had the benefit of having seen Man of Steel and heard the criticism as he was making this. I can't even say before he was making it, probably as he was making it. So it was probably in this, but I think he may have emphasized it just a touch more because he heard that criticism. And I don't really have a problem with it. I think it was, like I said, more obvious, less subtle, as you said, Sean, but I don't think it was something where you say, oh, that doesn't belong or that was bad. It was probably going to be in there all along. I think he just maybe, again, emphasized it a little.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, overall, I thought it was solid. I really enjoyed it. I just think it might be a little bit more for me than it is for the non-comic book reader.
I don't know. It seems to be going over well with everybody.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to confuse people. I think people who have a knowledge of, you know, the comics that it's based on are going to get more out of it. But I don't think it's something that's so abstract or inscrutable that people are going to go into this movie like, well, what the heck is Ultron? Well, people are just going to go, well, Ultron is a robot that Tony Stark made, and they'll just go with that.
Hmm. And Paul Bettany was brilliant as the Vision.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do have to say the scene where the Vision picks up Thor's hammer just effortlessly was absolutely brilliant.
There was gasps in the theater. It was like, oh!
I think there were in my theater as well. And you know,
it was probably me going, what?
But I love the line at the end where Captain America and Iron Man are talking, you know, and saying with Thor saying, you know, but say if you put the hammer in the elevator and the elevator goes up, it's still lifting it. Doesn't mean that the
elevator's not worthy.
Yeah. See, that leads to my favorite character bit at the beginning where they're all at the party and Thor's face when Captain America tries to lift it, he's genuinely afraid he's going to be worthy. Mm-hmm. And that was a lovely little character bit.
Like moves slightly.
Yeah.
And the debate was, is he actually worthy and chose not to lift it because he doesn't want to, like, you know, get Thor upset?
Yeah, because Steve Rogers isn't Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he has none of the ego involved.
Yeah.
Or was he, like, you know, because realistically, it's not a partial test. It's all or nothing. Either you're worthy or you're not. So he wouldn't be able to move it slightly because he's kind of worthy.
Mm.
So the debate would be, I'm going to fall on the side of the fact that, yeah, he could have lifted it if he had wanted to.
Yeah, but you've got the whole Avengers JLA discussion as well, where Superman was worthy, and Thor argues, yeah, you're worthy in that moment. Next time, you may not be.
Well, that I go with, because there have been times where Thor wasn't worthy.
So in the middle of a battle where Cap's trying to save people's lives and has nothing but honorable intentions, I got the point there was he may be able to lift Thor's hammer.
See, I'm thinking in that room, if he had really wanted to, he could have.
Yeah.
Another
thing I want to hear people complain about is Superman had a beer in Superman Returns and people bitched and moaned about it. Nobody seemed to have moaned about that in Avengers 2.
That's silly.
Because they're all having a drink. Yeah.
Superman got drunk in Superman Returns, I would criticize it.
He got drunk in Superman 3. Nobody seemed to care about that.
Nobody liked Superman 3, that's why.
I liked Superman 3.
It was the kryptonite.
It was bad.
The kryptonite with the tar in it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, all that tar is bad for you.
Mm.
See? No, Paul Bettany was brilliant. Paul Bettany had some brilliant Superman moments in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was great.
I kept wanting to see more of him. Mm. Every time they showed the Vision, it was like, oh, get him back again.
Mm-hmm. He was wonderful. Great in it.
Especially seeing as he doesn't even remember doing Iron Man.
Really?
Really?
Yeah, there was an interview with him on 5 Live, the movie show with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo. Is every Friday afternoon. And it's a podcast, listen to it. It's a great movie show. And they had Paul Bettany on talking about some film or other he was in, and they asked him about being in the Marvel Universe and all of that stuff. And he says, I don't even remember doing Iron Man. I showed up in a recording studio in London. John Favreau gave me direction over Skype. I recorded it. It took 2 hours. I left.
Well, that's a good paycheck if you can get it, I would say.
Yeah. Well, that's what there's an interview with him I read just yesterday where he was on about this was much harder work because I had to show up and go through all that makeup. Whereas in the other ones, I just went into a recording booth.
As I said to Bill yesterday, I love the fact that they made the Vision look like the Vision. They didn't totally change him. You know, I mean, there's slight character model changes, but he looks like the Vision from the comics. They're not embarrassed to embrace the source material.
Well, now,
I loved where his cape came from as well.
Oh, yeah.
He looked at Thor and kind of went, that's a good look.
Now, I've got to ask, is the gem that's on, because I am an Avengers noob at best, is the gem that's embedded in the Vision's forehead, does that have any connection to an Infinity Stone, or is that just...
That seems to be new.
It doesn't in the comics, does it?
Okay.
I've never seen anything in the comics where it was linked to that, but I haven't read everything for the last few years, so it's possible there may be a story out there that I haven't seen where they did it.
Okay. Mm.
It definitely is in the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did anyone stay to the end?
Yep.
Yeah, same here. Okay.
There was nothing.
I think they're doing a disservice by not having something at the very end.
Yeah.
Because there are fans who are going to wait. They know the fans are going to wait now. So give them a little something at the end.
Yeah. Even, that's what the thing with Howard the Duck that was just so spectacular about Guardians of the Galaxy. You waited to the end to find out if something was there. And it was just this ridiculous scene. So I was kind of disappointed that I waited to the end. And
see, I thought that was funny.
that they kind of gypped us
10 minutes worth of credits to get a Howard the Duck cameo. That tickled my funny bone. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, that's fine. I had no problem with the fact that they did Howard the Duck at the end. I just want them to do something. They could have done another shawarma scene.
Yeah,
it would have been fine. Just the fans are, that the diehard fans are going to wait till the very end. You don't have to do anything elaborate, but just have something for them to reward them for sitting there and reading through all the credits.
Mm-hmm. Well, and reading through them is actually kind of a misnomer because they've got so damn many people working on this thing. There is no way you can read all of those names. I even had trouble trying to read like the creators' names that they had, all the creators that they had listed. And I think they got most of them.
Yeah, they thanked. I saw Bendis, Hitch, Byrne, Buscema,
Jim Starlin,
Thomas. Yeah, they had Starlin,
Thomas.
Stanley and Jack Kirby, they had several times, actually.
Right.
I think they did Simon as well.
Kirby should get multiple credits now he's being paid, or his family's being paid. So I have no problem with plastering Kirby's name all over these.
One of the things I was reading after I went and saw the movie, I read some stuff online. Someone was commenting about Stanley's cameo and how he was playing a veteran. And they were wondering if that was kind of hint of Stanley trying to play Jack Kirby, because Kirby essentially was a war veteran.
So was Stan Lee.
Oh, really?
I mean, I don't think he saw service, but he was in.
He was in the military.
Serve.
Okay.
But his little cameo yesterday was more Kirby-like. It was the kind of thing that Kirby would have said.
Hmm.
You know, just hand me that, for the drink.
Okay. That was funny. Excelsior.
My favorite Stan Lee cameo recently was in Daredevil. Did you spot it?
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Okay.
Absolutely fantastic.
Is it past where I've seen?
Yes.
I've only seen through episode 7.
Yeah, it's been there.
See, I have been so
busy. It's not
going
to ruin anything. Sean, it's not going to ruin anything
for you.
I don't got it. All I'll say, when somebody goes to the police station and there's the guy on the desk, look at the wall behind him.
Okay. See, because I don't know if you've seen Big Hero 6, there was a cameo by Stan Lee as a picture on the wall, and then Stan Lee had a cameo at the end of the movie as well.
I loved Big Hero 6.
That was a surprisingly good film. Disney has come out with some really, they come out with a new renaissance of, actually pretty good films that are computer animated recently, so.